The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I take that little sentence, except where FISA applies, and I try to explain where FISA applies, which means I'm doing a lot of spade work that they, you know, don't have to do, because if you're an operator inside NSA, you've got some, you know, guidelines from your lawyers and compliance personnel and your civil liberties folks and so forth. I'm trying to actually explain, you know, within the four corners of my document what is going on as well as I can, which means I've got to do a certain amount of foundation laying for some of the shorthand in the document, in the SIG annex itself.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 15th, 2021. The NSA this week released a long-awaited update to its signals intelligence policy, which had not been updated since, wait for it, 1988. It's a dense technical document, and so naturally, David Criss, former Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division, sat down, read it super carefully, and produced an even longer paper analyzing it. David joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the significance of NSA's new policy document, what it does and how it's different from the document it replaces. We also talked about his paper, how he came to write it, why it is so much longer than the policy document itself, and what the implications of the new NSA policies are for signals intelligence collection and civil liberties. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 15th, David Criss on the NSA Annex. David, I want to start, before we get to your project, with this large release of material that NSA dumped this week. A lot of people will have missed that it happened, given the late unpleasantness. But bring us up to speed. What is the material that NSA released, and what does it have to do with Donald Trump?
What NSA released is something called the SIGINT Annex. That is, it's a document that regulates signals intelligence, or SIGINT, and it is actually structured as an annex, or like an appendix, to the broader set of Defense Department rules around intelligence collection generally, which applies to NSA because it's a DoD entity. So this is the rule book for a certain set of signals intelligence collection and related activity by NSA and certain military elements. What it has to do with Donald Trump is that it was signed and approved by his Attorney General and Secretary of Defense before they departed, and occurred on his watch. But one of the things that everybody, I think, is concerned about is this somehow some kind of Trump-related document? Does it reflect a departure from, you know, intelligence under law or basic apolitical intelligence collection? And I can say, having read the document quite carefully, that while folks might disagree about how it strikes the balance between, you know, security and liberty or whatever, or other substantive quibbles with it or disagreements with it, but I didn't see anything in this, and I'm pretty sure there isn't anything in it that is partisan political or Trump political in that sense. This is a straight up career effort that's been going on for a long time and is frankly long overdue.
So tell us about that process. What has it consisted of? And how long has it been going on?
Well, I mean, it's part of a larger project of updating all or many of the intelligence community elements guidelines. There's an executive order that folks in the intelligence business are very familiar with, Executive Order 12333, issued by President Reagan and still in effect, having been modified by President George W. Bush a couple of times. But it is the basic backbone charter for the U.S. intelligence community. And that order prescribes that intelligence agencies or intelligence elements, any member of the intelligence community, needs to have guidelines that govern the way in which they collect and do other things with process and retain and disseminate information that implicates U.S. persons' Fourth Amendment rights. And those guidelines have to be adopted by the head of the relevant agency and then approved and signed off by the Attorney General. This is a reform, and the requirement for this for these kinds of guidelines is a reform that goes back to the mid-1970s and the disclosures from the Church and Pike committees about all of the horrendous, you know, terrifying abuse that the intelligence community has had engaged in. And one of the big reforms that came out of that was the need for these kinds of guidelines. So this is the latest in the NSA and U.S. Signals Intelligence System, SIGINT, guidelines. And it's it's kind of astonishing, but the document it replaces was last substantively updated in the Reagan administration in the late 1980s. So that's what I meant when I said it was overdue, because obviously the legal and technological and threat environment has shifted quite a bit since 1988.
So who decided, you know, we haven't updated this since 1988. Maybe we should get on it. How did that process start and who decided to do it and when?
Yeah, I don't actually know, you know, when it went from just a gleam in the eye of someone somewhere and became operationalized. I can tell you it's been going on for a while, and it was anticipated when the Defense Department issued its new guidelines a few years ago. And the community actually has released a schedule of all the various intelligence guidelines that have been updated recently. And I should say, it's not strange to have these documents finalized in the very, very last days of an administration, because they're just so hard, so complicated, so detailed and difficult, frankly, that you just need the most severe forcing function to make them happen. And so, you know, the CIA's corresponding guidelines, which I reviewed separately in a long paper for Lawfare when they came out, you know, emerged, I think, even closer to the change in administrations coming out of at the very end of the Obama administration. So I don't know exactly when this particular SIGINT annex started being revised, but it was probably a long time ago and, you know, called for and needed in light of the prior revision to the general DOD guidelines.
All right. So the document itself, what did NSA release? Did they release the annex itself, or did they release material connected to it? Presumably, the guidelines have a significant classified dimension. So talk about what NSA has made public here.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job on classification, I will say, and I'm not sure it was easy for them. The DOD manual to which this is an annex is, I think, entirely unclassified. If it's not, it's very largely so. And this annex is very largely unclassified. There are some redactions, places where it's blanked out and you can't tell, at least I can't tell what, you know, is going on behind that. But it's pretty modest. This is a very transparent document. I mean, you know, transparent enough that I was able to write 75 single space pages or around 40,000 words about it. So it tells you a lot. There are some pieces that you can't see and you don't know. And of course, you know, it's not the only relevant document that governs SIGINT. In fact, they have another big revision that is forthcoming of a document called UCID 18, United States Signals Intelligence Directive number 18, which is even more nuts and boltsy than this thing. So a lot of it's available, almost all of it. You can discern quite a bit. They've leaned forward, I think, on transparency here. And so that, you know, gives you a lot of grist for the mill.
And for those who say, I don't want to read the mere David Chris commentary.
No.
I want to go to the original source. No Talmud for me. I want the actual text. How long is it?
Oh, I think it's a little over 30 pages of operative text. And it's, you know, I wouldn't call it beach reading. I have it right here in my hand. So yeah, if you knock out the table of contents and various other, you know, stuff, the glossary and so forth, it's a little over 33, 34 pages. And it's really technical. And it's not like they're trying to obfuscate. The authors of this are trying to write as clearly and as well as they can. They're, you know, kind of have the problem of serving a little bit two audiences. On the one hand, this is a document for operational personnel who actually do SIGINT professionally for a living. And it's pitched in some ways to them. It's also a document that can be unpacked and understood by outsiders, but it takes a certain amount of unpacking and effort.
All right. So 30 pages of occupational text and 75 pages.
Okay. Nobody's perfect.
Of David Chris commentary. Walk me through this.
Yeah, there's some self-deprecating humor in the paper about how, you know, long and boring it is. And maybe some people will find that over the top. I guess I just think of it as an antidote to the standard Washington self-aggrandizement. But this is not easygoing. But, you know, they say things in the manual like, this is the rule that governs except where FISA applies, the FISA being the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which is, you know, no slouch itself in the length and difficulty Olympics. And so part of the reason my paper is so long is I take that little sentence, except where FISA applies, and I try to explain where FISA applies, which means I'm doing a lot of spade work that they, you know, don't have to do, because if you're an operator inside NSA, you've got some, you know, guidelines from your lawyers and compliance personnel and your civil liberties folks and so forth. I'm trying to actually explain, you know, within the four corners of my document, what is going on as well as I can, which means I've got to do a certain amount of foundation laying, you know, for some of the shorthand in the document, in the SIGINT annex itself.
Yeah, just for those of you who don't get the little quip David just made, saying this rule applies except where FISA applies is a little bit like saying, follow this rule unless the Bible has anything to say about it.
That's pretty good, Ben. You got the Talmud and the Bible already going, so we got religious overtones for sure.
Follow this rule for all conduct not covered by Title 18.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, understanding sort of, you know, how the overall SIGINT pie is sliced up into some parts of which are regulated by FISA, some by the FISA Amendments Act, and some just by these procedures and other aspects that fall under Executive Order 12333. That's a non-trivial task, knowing where those lines are. And I try to, you know, lay that out, because it's actually a source of potentially vast and horrible misunderstanding. Because if you read this document, the SIGINT Annex from NSA now, without knowing like that FISA really does take a pretty big slice out of the pie, you know, you might really draw some very wrong conclusions and go down a long rabbit trail of misery and suffering. So, you know, that's not the only reason my paper is so long. Part of the other reason is that I'm verbose and enjoy turgid prose with endless nuance and you know, caveats.
This is actually false. You're I say this at the risk of undermining your self-presentation as a self-deprecatory, but your prose is actually clipped and spare as a general matter.
Ben, coming from you, that means something, because I like your writing too. But anyway, I've done my best to really try to just explain it, you know, as fully as I can. I don't think you couldn't give this to, you know, someone with absolutely no background in the space, but it's certainly meant for a non-specialist, just generally well-educated audience. That's the, you know, that was the level I was pitching it at, so that like a normal, smart human could come to grips with it.
So I want to ask how you came to write it. You know, this is a document that was released Wednesday.
Yeah.
You've written nearly 80 pages on it. Presumably that didn't happen in the 24 hours since the document was released.
Oh man, you're making me look bad. Yeah.
you're fast, but you're not that fast. And everything you write on issues like this is subject to government declassification review, pre-publication review. So just walk us through. You did a similar thing with the CIA's material. Talk to us about how you came to write this.
Yeah, I have been on, and I'm allowed to say that I've been on the NSA advisory board, what they call the NSAB, or used to be called the NSASAB. But it's an outside group of advisors who, you know, help out at the fort. And so I had an early look at the unclassified version of this. And so I did have a head start on writing it. I think they also gave it to some journalists maybe ahead of time, too. It's not an uncommon practice. And I have a, you know, really profound interest in intelligence law and rules. So, you know, I'm not sure there's that many people who would willingly write this paper. And I do want to say, you know, the pre-publication review folks moved very, very rapidly through this document and got it approved really quickly. So I'm quite grateful to them. You know, I sometimes complain. They get complaints about them, of course, all the time, and they're doing a hard thing holding the line. But on this one, they really came through for me. So I'm grateful. So the whole thing was fast, but I wouldn't pretend I wrote it overnight. I did have some advance access to the unclassified document.
All right. So we've talked about the document at some extensive meta level here, but like, what's in it that's new? What are from your point of view, the big takeaways?
Well, one thing I think, you know, it's hard to do an apples to apples comparison of this document to its predecessor. I know folks want to do that because they sort of want to know, well, does the government now have more authority or less authority than it used to have? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask. It just turns out that for a bunch of reasons, it's very difficult to answer it because so much has changed by way of the legal baseline, the technological baseline and other things since 1988. So, you know, I try to give a lot of detail and comparison to the predecessor document, but I sort of avoided a single bumper sticker answer to whether it's more or less protective, because in some ways it's more, in some ways it's less, I think. You know, fundamentally, the SIGINT Annex has got seven sections. One is a sort of a general section, and then the others are about collection of signals intelligence, about processing and querying of signals intelligence, retention of what's been collected and processed, dissemination, meaning sharing. And then there's a whole section on policy compliance, training, and auditing, and a final section that deals with U.S. person targets outside the United States. You know, there's a couple of big things worth noting. The first is the emphasis on querying. Querying, you know, you go back far enough, querying's not really a thing in the sense of when you're dealing with, you know, paper or even to some extent with magnetic tape and some of the older modalities, you know, just you can't, you know, querying would be somebody looking through the Rolodex to find the desired name.
Yeah, there's no section on it in the Church Committee report.
Yeah, right. No, you know, in the prior document, there's no really explicit. It's dealt with under the rubric of collection or sometimes in slightly other ways. But they've really built out the querying section in part because it's you know, just for technological and as well as policy reasons, it's now more of a thing. I think there's an effort here also to make this document a little technology neutral or less technology specific. So the prior one, I think, had more emphasis on the differences between like radio frequency, radio collection, wireless collection versus wired or cable. This one is trying to be more neutral. You know, it's in certain ways, I think, more prescriptive. In a lot of ways, actually, I think more prescriptive than its predecessor. It's almost like what they did in writing this thing is they kind of took all of the questions that the operators were asking, I had a feeling, or that operators could ask, and they tried to bake them in. So it's almost got a built-in FAQ in the document itself, which is part of why it's a little bit longer. Another difference it takes advantage of, and it takes cognizance of, the big development in NSA civil liberties and compliance infrastructure that has developed, you know, since 1988. I mean, they now have a whole director of compliance in his office. They have a civil liberties and privacy officer and her office. There's the PCLOB. You know, the environment's changed there too, and they can leave a little more of the granular stuff to those professionals. And so in certain ways, it's more prescriptive. In a couple of ways, it may be a little bit less so, because you've got people who are responsible for implementation. So to give you a concrete example, so this doesn't just sound all airy-fairy. So the old annex like had a particular form that prescribed the exact words you had to use in order to get somebody's consent to do SIGINT. So that might be literally somebody in the intelligence community would be consenting to be a SIGINT target. And there was literally a form, and if you deviated from the form, you were in violation of the procedures. So they've taken that out and just said, you know, get a proper knowing voluntary consent. And they have people who know how to do that. But in a lot of other ways, it describes more precisely what needs to be done. So those are probably the main like differences from the predecessor document and the main things that this new document tries to accomplish.
So obviously, there hasn't been a lot of time for people to think about it yet in the public sphere. But when you look at it from the point of view of what the major criticisms of it are going to be from people who think the rules are insufficiently restrictive or from people who think the rules are too restrictive, what do you look at it and say, well, these are the areas that are going to, you know, please upset different groups of people, civil libertarians, you know, technology companies, enthusiasts for surveillance, etc.?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Once they get through it, I actually have some doubt about how people are going to feel about it. I mean, you can predict, I guess, but I am sure the querying rules will draw a lot of attention, in keeping with the idea that querying in general has drawn a lot of attention. And there will be arguments about whether they are tightly enough drawn or whether they ought to be more restrictive. And frankly, I think that's sort of part of a larger debate about whether and to what extent, you know, more of the what I call the SIGINT pie ought to be brought under statutory or even judicial regulation. So I think broadly speaking, you can expect some pushes in that direction, and that wouldn't be surprising, and it wouldn't be unhealthy in a properly functioning democracy. I personally think also the document could be a little bit clearer in stating in kind of one place the proper purposes for which SIGINT can be conducted. It's quite clear in saying that, you know, you can't do SIGINT for purposes of gathering loveint or something like that.
Not even if the target is, you know, Hillary Clinton or Hunter Biden or,
yeah, okay, you know. Here we go. Yep.
Just checking.
Just checking. Thank you for that, Ben.
I'm actually being semi-serious. I think a lot of people listening to this right now are going to be skeptical that a serious policy document about the collection of information and retention and querying of information just kind of emerges right at the end of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And that there isn't any element of it that is, you know, about making sure we get Hunter Biden.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I understand that concern, and I can only tell you sort of two things. One, this is not the first time one of these documents gets done at the end. In fact, more often than not, I think they are done at the end just because they're so damn hard. And to really get them squared away, teed up, and presented to the grownups for signature is just very tough and requires the most strict forcing function of like, hey, I'm leaving the day before Christmas. So if you want this signed and you don't want to start over with the next crew, you better get this done by then, because otherwise I'm going home. Yeah, I can imagine that conversation between, you know, the National Security Division and Bill Barr, and a corresponding one, I'm sure, at DOD. So one thing to say is just don't be alarmed by the timing here, because it's really actually quite routine, and there's plenty of precedent for it, to include those CIA guidelines that came out at the end of the Obama administration. Second thing is, I looked at this thing as hard as I can look at it, and I am sure other people will look at it very hard too. And while there are some redactions, you know, I don't think there's any way to believe that there's that kind of Easter egg hidden inside of this thing.
No special Rudy Giuliani section?
I mean, maybe if they snuck it in the redacted parts, but no, it's not a real concern if you've looked hard at the document. And the people who worked on this, you know, are credible deep staters, you know, so I don't see that. You know, the kinds of debates one can have about this document, and here I may lose half the audience like pretty quick, is, you know, what how can you do SIGINT? For what reasons? Well, you know, they say three in the document. One is in support of a proper intelligence mission. That makes sense. NSA is an intelligence agency, so they do SIGINT in support of intelligence missions. Those missions are determined through a separate, you know, mechanism, but sort of it's almost axiomatic that NSA collects for intelligence, foreign intelligence purposes. Second is in support of military goals. Well, once again, nothing surprising there. NSA is a DOD element, and they, you know, support the warfighters. So that's what you'd expect. Then there's this third thing, which is you can do it in certain kind of hostage situations where a U.S. person, an American, has been kidnapped or taken captive abroad. And that one is a little bit strange in the way it's worded. There is a relatively recent new Trump memorandum about this that seems to have a little bit stronger language in it than we've seen before, you know. But I mean, you have to know that Obama, Bush, and others have had similar hostage related memos, and signals intelligence was always done for hostage reasons. I've told NSA, just for the record, you have my consent. If I'm captured by terrorists abroad, please do target my mobile phone. I hope you find me. You know, but I mean, not to make light of it, but, you know, so there's some deviation in the hostage taking purpose for SIGINT. And I think there's a certain failure to articulate some other narrow purposes that are also specified in other parts of the document. But so we're not talking about anything crazy like the Hunter Biden or Rudy Giuliani exception. We're talking about very, very small bore, relatively technical, not trivial, but you know, within the zone of legitimate policy debate. There's interesting stuff there for a certain kind of SIGINT nerdy set. But there's just nothing in this document that, you know, I don't know, is going to appeal to or implicate QAnon or anything really nutty like that. Just not that kind of document.
What is the area where the ACLU is going to look at it and say, this is the spot where it expands permission over what we would have expected the most? And conversely, what are the areas where, you know, the people who believe we should have eyes on everybody who, you know, anybody might ever suspect is of being a bad guy all the time.
Yeah.
They're going to complain is the area where it most restricts over what they would have expected.
So I'm a very poor proxy for, you know, both sides of that question. So I'll do my best, but I'm probably going to be dead wrong and sound foolish when someone plays this back to me. For the ACLU and the strong proponents of civil liberties, and maybe I can do them better, you know, I think it's going to probably be focused on querying and maybe to a lesser extent on retention of information. There's quite a lot of flexibility, I think, in the retention here, the rules for how long you keep data. And again, querying, just that's a hot topic, and understandably so, because we're collecting a lot of data, not targeting US persons. If you can then query that information, you know, under lesser standards, you know, you've got some issues there. And it is interesting, the querying rules are looser, I think, than the front-end collection rules. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, your ability to query data is broader than your ability to collect it in the first instance. But it's not so broad as to say that you can just query for any foreign intelligence purpose whatsoever. Okay, so I think both sides will find that compromise unsatisfactory. I also think on the sort of pro-collection side, I'm sure there will be some grumbling and objection that this is a longer, more complicated, more prescriptive document that takes on, you know, more detail in light of the legal and other environment. You know, my experience is the operators, sort of understandably, I have some sympathy. I mean, I have sympathy for both sides. I have sympathy for the civil libertarians and the, you know, those who have concerns that the government could do a lot with this document. And I have concerns for those who have to live and operate within it, because it's a pretty complicated rule set. I was the chief compliance officer of a big company, and, you know, you got a lot of complicated rule sets you have to live within. It can be tough, especially when you're trying to operate under pressure. So I can see the point of view of both sides. I think I can take a guess, but I may not be right. But I would imagine it'll be around querying, retention, and just the overall prescriptive complexity of this thing.
So the first section of this document, and I will not pretend to have read it, but I am told by authoritative sources that the first section of this document is historical. Why is it useful or important for the annex to have a historical section?
Yeah.
And what work is that doing?
It's something I did when I wrote the CIA guidelines paper. I tried to explain the history of what was the focus of that paper, which was open source or public information collection, and how that had evolved. And I felt obligated to do something similar here on the history of SIGINT, just because signals intelligence, you know, is not a something that everybody is familiar with or knows really even very much about. And so I thought, and I still think, that the SIGINT annex and its rules make more sense when they're evaluated against the historical background from which they came. I think that's true sort of up and down the line of these executive regulations. I mean, for example, Executive Order 12333 has a provision about, you know, human experimentation needing to be done only in compliance with HHS guidelines. That is a, you know, very, very strange provision to include in an executive order that purports to govern the U.S. intelligence community as opposed to the Department of Health and Human Services, until you learn that there's a history of CIA doing, you know, LSD drug experiments on unwitting Americans. And then it makes more sense. And so here I go through the history of SIGINT to include, you know, the abuses that are disclosed by the Church and Pike committees, including Operation Shamrock and Minaret, and the stuff they did for the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. So the bad stuff that was exposed in the 70s, and also the pressure created and the need for expansion by 9/11. And there's a section even on the, you know, current environment with technological change, with the threats changing from, you know, terrorists with kinetic attacks to nation state adversaries with cyber and information attacks, and the, you know, frankly, the domestic political environment that we're in. I think all of that is important background for understanding sort of how these rules operate in context. You need to remember both that, you know, the intelligence community is capable of doing some really bad things and has done some really bad things in the past. So they need to be regulated. On the other hand, you need to recognize there's pretty severe foreign intelligence threats out there, and those need to be countered, and the intelligence community's got to be in a position to counter them effectively. So the history is there to sort of give people a sense of, like, how did this rule set come to be? How can it make sense given all the things that have happened? We don't want to be fighting the last war, but we do want to be cognizant of our history in evaluating our rules and how appropriate they are. That's why, you know, part of the reason, frankly, you know, military officers are trained in military history a lot of the time, not so they can fight the last war, so that they can learn the lessons of the last war and apply them to the next one. So that's the reason for the history. I'm not a historian by any stretch of the imagination, but I had the benefit of using some historical sources that were, I thought, quite well done. And it's just sort of nifty. I mean, like, one thing I just loved, like, I'm sorry, this is probably not very interesting to most people, but, like, you know, literally in the middle of World War II, the Army and the Navy are at each other's throats over who's going to control SIGINT. And they end up having their disputes arbitrated in such a way that, like, literally the Army gets to go and do SIGINT on the Japanese on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and the Navy does it Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, which is not a prescription.
He was better at it.
Yeah, well, eventually the Navy got really interested in doing stuff out at sea and on ships, and they had other responsibilities, so a lot of it moved over to the Army, actually. But, like, anybody who's worked in Washington, D.C. and been in, you know, in the interagency and had these knife fights in dark alleys that, you know, are part of the interagency process sometimes, will appreciate the fact that there's, like, some historical antecedents for that kind of interagency disputes. And they can affect mission pretty profoundly if they're not well kept well in hand.
So, you know, one of the things that has really sharpened the divide, even pre-Trump, between the United States and Europe over the last few years has been this very different attitude toward data and toward government access to data, at least U.S. government access to data. How is the release of this document likely to impact, you know, the transatlantic data divide between Europeans and Americans on issues like, you know, the GDPR and the Schrems decision, where, you know, European countries are in the EU are super suspicious of the way the United States, what it permits with respect to data collection and querying and other storage and manipulations?
I think it could be important to that debate, because this is a very significant document that regulates, you know, NSA's collection under 12333 outside of FISA, which is sort of one of the two things that the European Court was most concerned with, the other being 702, FISA Amendments Act, Section 702. So for at least, you know, part of the problem that animated the Schrems decision, this is the best public articulation, the SIGINT Annex, that is the best public articulation of the rules under which that work is done. And although I'm very wary of reductionism and, you know, sort of turning something this complicated into a slogan, I did make an effort on behalf of long-suffering policy experts and lawyers everywhere to sort of summarize in the conclusion to this paper in part three the protections that apply both to U.S. persons and persons in this country, on the one hand, and also to non-U.S. persons, European persons, let's say, who are located abroad. And there's no question this document, like many U.S. intelligence laws, is more protective of either people in this country or Americans, wherever they are. But it's still got protections that extend to Europeans or others outside this country. And it's, you know, those shouldn't be ignored. The European courts and others will make of them what they will. And, you know, people will argue back and forth whether they're enough, too much, not enough, whatever it is. But I did feel like, having gone through this document, I should try to comb through it, collect up the various elements of it that do address privacy and protect people's privacy and sort of lay them out. And then people can go to town as they wish. So it's my little gesture of solidarity with folks working the Schrems issue on both sides of the Atlantic.
Will Max Schrems be satisfied?
I assume not. I think that's a fair bet. But,
well,
you know,
Max Schrems, if you want to write your response to David's paper, Lawfare would, of course, be happy to publish that.
I will say, if this SIGINT Annex is a hard document, and I found writing this paper to be very difficult. And so I published with even more than the usual amount of trepidation. So if a really smart person who's highly focused and educated and does a lot of hard work finds an error, then I would be happy to hear it and, you know, make corrections. So send those right to Ben Wittes and he can let me know.
So one last question. You know, most of the documents that have emerged in the last bunch of years have a, you know, a pretty strong counterterrorism lilt to them. Over the last few years, we have been realizing that, you know, great power conflict is still with us, whether we think it's gone or not. And by the way, cyber intrusions are a choice tool among lots of our adversaries. Should we understand this primarily as part of the sort of post 9/11 rewriting of the rules, or is this the post 9/11 reorientation towards cyber?
I think probably in the main, this is just an update that accounts for the truly massive technological and legal change that has occurred since 1988. I mean, I started going back and looking at some of the Fourth Amendment decisions from the Supreme Court that came out, you know, since then, and it's a lot of law. And certainly technology has shifted. Just, you know, the internet was not really a thing back in those days, you know, except maybe in very narrow ways.
But boy, we were rocking the early days of the touch tone telephone.
Yeah, those giant like car phones or the big bricks you would carry around, I guess. So I think, you know, principally it reflects that. I think it does look to me like it's a document that is adapted for or can be used well in the post-9/11, you know, current framework in which, as I mentioned, we've really shifted from, you know, a focus on a terrorist threat with a kinetic modality to, you know, nation state 2+3 framework with cyber and information operations. I don't see anything in this document that gets in the way of, you know, defend forward and persistent engagement. And actually, there's a pretty long discussion of the current threat and technology environment and the way in which this interacts with those cyber and defense doctrines of persistent engagement and defending forward. So it certainly can be seen that way. But I think the main thing was it was just like, my God, we haven't updated this since 1988. And, you know, things are moving around us. We can't just keep clinging to this document. But those who are interested in the shift into the 2+3 threat environment and how technology works, there's some good parts of this document that try to lay that out. And frankly, they quote a lot from General Nakasone, who's the director of NSA and also the commander of Cyber Command, who is very, very smart, very knowledgeable, really quite articulate in explaining how those doctrines work and how things are playing out in the cyber environment today. So folks who are a little less interested in the technical side of this and the gory details of how SIGINT is done, I suppose might also be interested in the part at the end of the historical section that talks about today's threats and issues.
We're going to leave it there. The NSA Annex can be found on Lawfare, as can David's analysis of it, if you dare. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. I enjoyed it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com, and you know you have been meaning to go to thelawfarestore.com. You should tweet about the Lawfare podcast if your Twitter account has not yet been banned. You should share us on Facebook if Facebook is still tolerating your presence. You should pin us on Pinterest if you haven't been suspended from that. And you should, of course, make TikTok videos about us if you have downloaded TikTok, which you mustn't do. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.